Welcome to Whiskey Cast, the Cask Strength podcast featuring news and interviews from the world of whiskey. I'm Mark Gillespie. This is episode number 271 for July 25th, 2010. Coming up in a few minutes.
This is like a blender's dream come true. It's like going into the Tutankhamun, discovering all the jewels, all the gold, everything about it associated with his cave.
That's White & Mackay master blender Richard Patterson on the lead story this week. The decision to thaw out one of the cases of whiskey left behind in Antarctica by Sir Ernest Shackleton's South Pole expedition in 1908. I caught up with Richard this week at Federal Wine and Spirits in Boston. That's just one of the things we talked about, and you'll also hear Richard's unique version of the history of Scotch whiskey. I also talked with Federal's Joe Howell about the business of selling whiskey. All that's coming up in a few minutes. First, though, let's check the week's news, brought to you by Glenmorangie. More on the lead story now. Word came from New Zealand this week that the scientists in charge of preserving historic sites on Antarctica have decided to thaw out a case of the whiskey found frozen in the ice under one of the huts used by Shackleton's expedition. There are intact bottles inside the case, but no one knows yet whether there's still whiskey inside those bottles, and if so, what condition it's in. If there's liquid inside the bottles after the case thaws, the plans are for Richard to travel to New Zealand at some point and extract a sample with a syringe. He may or may not be able to recreate the whiskey inside, and he'll explain more on that later. One thing is certain, though, the case will eventually be returned to Antarctica, since international treaties prohibit the permanent removal of artifacts from the continent. McTeers has its next whiskey auction scheduled for August 18th in Glasgow, and the highlight of the auction isn't quite as rare as Shackleton's whiskey, but has some historical value nonetheless. A bottle of Ballantine's whiskey recovered from the 1941 shipwreck of the SS Politician off the island of Eriskay will go on the block. Of course, that's the shipwreck that inspired the novel and movie Whiskey Galore, along with other books and songs about the islanders who raced to salvage as much whiskey as they could before a customs officer blew up the rest of the ship to stop the looting. This bottle is expected to sell for up to £1,800, or about $2,800 at current exchange rates. An update now on last week's email on the Great Beer War and new developments this week in the battle to brew the world's strongest beer. As of last week's show, Scotland's BrewDog was the clubhouse leader with its Sink the Bismarck at 41% ABV. Got an email from Matt earlier this week. He saw an article on Germany's Schorschbrau brewery reclaiming the title with a 43% ABV Schorschbach. But BrewDog went nuclear this week, too. Not literally, of course. Having already used the name Tactical Nuclear Penguin for one of their high-proof beers, the BrewDog boys have released 11 bottles of The End of History, a 55% ABV beer that's as strong as many cask-strength whiskeys. The reason there are only 11 bottles available, each one comes inside a taxidermist-prepared roadkill carcass. There are 7 stoats, or weasels, and 4 squirrels. All have been sold at prices of £500 for the stoats and £700 for the squirrels, making them likely the world's most expensive beers as well. BrewDog says this will be its last high-strength beer, no matter what Schorschbrau does in the future. Jack Daniel's, meanwhile, celebrates the 160th birthday of its namesake in September, and there will be a special bottle to commemorate the occasion. Jack Daniel was born in September 1850, but the exact date remains a mystery because the records have been lost over the years. There will be special events to mark the birthday at the distillery in Lynchburg, Tennessee, as well as around the U.S. and in many of the 135 countries where Jack Daniel's is sold. If you heard the special episode from the Victoria Whiskey Festival last January, you might remember the panel discussion on the state of Canadian whiskey. It's taken a long time, but finally there's a website devoted exclusively to Canadian whiskeys. It's been created by longtime malt maniac and proud Canadian Davin DeKergamo, and will have tasting notes and other features. You can find it at CanadianWhiskey.org, and there's a link at the WhiskeyCast website. If you're going to be in the New York area in late August, the Whiskey Guild has its Whiskey on the Hudson tasting and dinner cruise planned for August 26th. And Dr. Whiskey, Sam Simmons, has a special treat planned for Balvenie's Warehouse 24 Club members. Sam is also the East Coast brand ambassador for the Balvenie and has pulled together at least 18 different Balvenie expressions for tasting that night. The list includes at least one distillery-only bottling and two new expressions to be released this fall, including this year's special 17-year-old bottling. Sam will join me on the next episode to discuss that bottling and the Warehouse 24 tasting. Now, here's the catch. You have to have both a Whiskey on the Hudson ticket and be a Warehouse 24 Club member to get into the room that night. You'll find links for both at the WhiskeyCast website. We heard from Sean Denay of Francis Glen Armour Distillery last February in episode 241. Back then, he said there would be a new release of his Glen Armour Cornog Peated Single Malt this summer. Well, it just went on sale this weekend to mark the distillery's fifth anniversary. 322 bottles at 46% ABV are available through the distillery's visitor center. Ian McLeod is now exporting its Glengoyne and Smokehead single malts to India. The 10, 17, and 21-year-old Glengoynes will be available, along with the Smokehead Isla single malt. Ian McLeod is also sending its King Robert II blended scotch to India. And that's the news, brought to you by Glenmorangie, handcrafted by the 16 Men of Tane since 1843. Let's check the emails of the week now, brought to you by Oban. Got an email from Mark Weems about the recent Phage Isle series. Dear Mark, I got a few weeks behind on the podcast, but I started commuting again and have been catching up on past episodes. I especially loved your week in Isla. Hearing from the locals and hearing the music really transported me to the festival. Hopefully I can travel to Port Weems someday to see if I can find any long-lost relatives. Until then, I hope they invite you back for next year's festival. All the best, Mark. Thanks, Mark, for your email. By the way, Mark spells his last name W-E-E-M-S, thanks to U.S. Customs, who changed it when his ancestors came from Scotland. Port Weems in Scotland, of course, is spelled W-E-M-Y-S-S. Andrew Durbidge emailed me with a follow-up to our conversation last week about the Australian Malt Whiskey Tasting Championship. He wanted to thank Glenmorangie for helping sponsor the event and the post-competition party. Consider them thanked. Had a few comments on last week's interview with Lafroig Stillman, Alan Hislop. Our buddy Shai Gilboa from Israel posted on Facebook that Alan's also a photography lover, and that when he was in the still room shooting photos of Alan, they passed the time talking about lenses instead of whiskey. If you have a comment or a question, you can post something on the WhiskeyCast Facebook page, too, or just email me. My email address is comments@whiskeycast.com. And the emails of the week are brought to you this time around by Oban Single Malt Whiskey, from the coastal town of Oban since 1794. Time now for the calendar of events, brought to you by Lafroig. History fans, the Bradford House Whiskey Rebellion Dinner is July 30th in Washington, Pennsylvania. The Beer, Bourbon, and Barbecue Festival is August 6th and 7th in Cary, North Carolina. The Fringe Festival dominates Edinburgh during August, and the Scotch Malt Whiskey Society has special tastings planned. Royal Mile Whiskies holds Whiskey Fringe in Edinburgh on August 14th and 15th. Auchentoshan Distillery in Glasgow will hold its annual Open Day and Festival August 28th. And whiskey clubs from around Europe will gather for Maltstock 2010, the weekend of September 3rd through the 5th in Nijmegen, the Netherlands. You'll find a complete calendar of events at the WhiskeyCast website, and it's brought to you by Lafroig. Just click on the Lafroig banner at the WhiskeyCast website to become a friend of Lafroig and claim your own square foot of Isla. I was in Boston Tuesday for a visit by Richard Patterson of White & Mackay to Federal Wine & Spirits, where he led a couple of tastings in the store's wine cellar and a master class at the nearby Omni Parker House Hotel.
First of all, you've got to be excited about the news coming out of New Zealand that it looks like you may finally get a chance to see what's left of Shackleton's whiskey.
This is something that is dream come true, because you've got to remember, I've been actually associated with this find for the last nearly coming up 4 years. They said they were going to go and get it. They couldn't get it because of winter closing in. And finally, they found the whiskey. But now what we've done, not only found it, but it's been taken to New Zealand. It's thawing, and they're going to take the bottle out. And it's like a dream come true. Hopefully, I'll now have a chance, maybe perhaps, to have the privilege and honor of sampling that whiskey. Now, remember, this is a whiskey that's been in the fridge for over 102 years. This is not a whiskey that's been in a bottle. It's been frozen in time, and this goes back to probably 1897. So this is like a blender's dream come true. It's like going into the Tutankhamun, discovering all the jewels, all the gold, everything about it associated with his cave, and this is what's going to happen with the whiskey. We're going to see it, what it actually looks like, but I will not know what the whiskey looks like until finally we do open up and then discover what it has to say about itself.
Will you be able to get enough of it, or how much realistically do you need to be able to recreate it from? How much of a sample would you need to get your hands on?
Right, what you've got to remember is that whiskey is going to be frozen as it comes out of the case. I want it to be remain fairly cold, and then I want the warmth of the temperature of the room to slowly come in and then open it up. It should be with me within about 30, 40 seconds, but I will not make a decision on that until I've at least given it 2, 3, 4, maybe 5 hours to let it come to room temperature and to reveal its inner warmth, its inner treasures. Remember, this is not something you can hurry. You've got to leave the whiskey to come into the new world. It's been frozen for 102 years, therefore let it come in its own time, and hopefully it'll reveal what it has to say about itself.
How soon do you expect to get your hands on it, or get your nose on it, as the case may be?
I would like to think that if it's an opportunity, this is now the end of July. I would like to think within the next 2 or 3, maybe months, I might have an opportunity to go there and to sample it. It's not quite a quick fix. It's not just looking at it and opening the cork. We will have to preserve as much of that bottle as possible. That means taking a special syringe, slipping it down the side of the glass, side of the cork, extracting it, everything about it, preserving it, putting it in the nosing glass, swirling it around, and then letting it come up, and then hopefully it will reveal itself and tell me something about the whiskey. But I need to see what it says on the label, because we don't know at this time whether it is a single malt, a blended malt, or a blended whiskey.
It could be any one of the three.
It could well be, and that's why it's very important that we actually look and see the whiskey and then see what it has to say about itself.
Now, you're here tonight to talk about the Dalmore, and let's talk about the Clan MacKenzie edition, because when that first came out, I didn't realize that was coming over to the U.S. I thought it was going to be U.K. only, and turns out we're getting a 1,200 bottles or so of this one over in the States.
We actually produced 3,000 bottles of this fantastic single malt. This is a single malt whiskey born 17th December 1992 that's been in port wine. This was in 20 butts of port wine, and 5 really showed its beauty, its style. But a lot of people think, you just put it in the wood and we left it there. No, we didn't. We had to monitor it, and it's been remaining in the port wine wood for 7 long years. So when you smell it, because it is 46% alcohol, only 3,000 bottles were produced. And yes, you're right, Mark. We have actually released for America 1,200 bottles. They've literally just arrived this week. They are the most beautiful, elegant whiskies you can imagine. Soft, elegant, refined, 46% alcohol. You must keep at the top of the tongue, underneath the tongue, back in the middle, and then let it go down. And it will show all its beautiful crimson colors, its elegance, its refinement, that soft lusciousness of the port wine. And it is a real whiskey to remember.
Now, when we were talking earlier, you hinted that another very special Dalmore is coming down the line here in the next month or two, right?
It might be actually longer than that. What we're going to do is we've got some very expensive Chateau Lafite casks. We're not sure what we're going to, if we're going to release them for the MacKenzie or not. And that's what I'm really considering about doing it. Because the MacKenzie clan, just to reiterate, as you'll see, you've got a picture here. I know the viewers can't see this. The listeners can't see. This is Castle Loud, and this is the home of the Clan Mackenzie. You'll see it's a very beautiful, elegant castle. It's been there for literally thousands of centuries, etc., and it needs an upkeep, and the upkeep is very expensive. When you have a castle in Scotland today, it needs renovation, it needs to be looked at, and it takes a lot of money. But what we've done is, with the Clan Mackenzie bottling, the proceeds from that bottling will go towards the restoration of this home of the Clan Mackenzie. We're delighted, honoured to have and look after the Mackenzie clan as much as we possibly can. So this edition, and probably future editions next year, will at least go some way towards preserving this great name.
But let's get back to that. Those Lafite casks, if you don't use them for the Mackenzie dram, what might you use them for?
Well, as you can imagine, I use many different styles of woods for many different countries, for many different people. And what it has to do is to preserve the quality of Dalmore. It has to be innovative, it has to be stylish. But one thing is certain, if I'm going to be producing Dalmore for White Mackay, and it's going to be part of our portfolio, it has to attain a particular style, but a very high quality. We're not sure if it's ready yet for releasing, and that's why we're monitoring the situation. But as soon as these whiskies are ready and they've reached their peak of perfection, we will then bottle it. But like anything else, I will not hurry it. It's the same with all our editions, whether it be the 12-year-old, 15, the 30, the 51, the 52, the 58, the 62, the 64. They will only be released when they're ready.
When we last got together on Jura at the end of May during the Fage, you had us picking casks for the next special release from Jura. Have you decided which one it's going to be yet?
Well, you're probably the first to hear about it, but you were there, Mark. There were a number of different casks, but I can tell you right now that cask number 30, some of you will remember this, cask number 30 was done in American white oak. It was fresh bourbon oak, and it gave it that lovely charm, that elegance, because make no mistake, Jura loves American white oak. Unlike Dalmore that loves sherry wood, Jura loves American white oak, and this was the peak of perfection, and it came out quite clear. For all the wonderful visitors that came from Islay, came from all over the world, that came to Jura on that day, that is the cask they selected, and that's the one we'll go with. It's not my decision, it's your bottling, it's your cask, and it's everything about it is your expression. And we'll be actually selling it at the distillery, because it's only right that we should sell it there. And if you were part of that, because your initials should be on the cask, I believe that we'll be giving you a special price with it.
I have to go back and check my photos now, because I signed two of the casks. I'm forgetting. I think I signed 29 and 30, but I'm going to have to go back and check now. But those are both excellent casks. What's next coming out of Jura?
Well, we were always looking, but I tell you right now, I'm really excited. You were down on Jura, and I mentioned to you, because this year is the 200th anniversary of Jura. And we want to make that a real memorable event. So what we've done is we've produced a 21-year-old Jura that has been matured in sherry wood. But this is not just any sherry wood. This is vintage sherry. This is vintage Gonzales Baez, 1963, the distillery was established in 1810. The distillery closed 1900, last cast to leave about 1913. And then we opened the distillery once again on the 26th of April, 1963. So that's why we've gone to Gonzales Baez. We've looked at all the vintages, and 1963 is a classic one for it. And we took the cask, and we've matured our 21-year-old, and it's got a superb gift box. It's an open face with side panels to let the air come in. It's all in silver, and that will be released later on the year. I can't remember the number of bottles that will be released, but it will be a memorable collection. But I can tell you right now, that 1963 21-year-old is a classic finish.
And I think you let us sample that out of that cask when we were there on Jura that day.
We showed you that at the beginning, not the fulfillment of it, because it's still going on. We like to leave it to the very last minute, but at least you got a taste of it, and I think you got that sort of wonderful round notes of the crimson, the stylish sherry wood that works. Because Jura, as I said to you, works with American white oak, but when it goes to the 18, 19, 21 years old, that's when we introduce sherry wood, and Jura responds admirably with it.
One final question. You're celebrating your 40th anniversary in September. Do you have a special dram planned to release or anything to commemorate it?
Nothing as yet, but what I've still got is I've still got the White Mackay 40-year-old. We've got another 40-year-old expression of Dalmore coming out. There's lots of different expressions of 40 years that mean a lot to me, but I like to think, you know, throughout my career, I produced one or two really memorable ones. I mean, you've seen them tonight. We've got the Clan Mackenzie, which is a classic one I remember with much affection. Same with the 1263. So I like to think that perhaps not just one to celebrate. There are many different expressions, but it's not a celebration just for myself. It's to celebrate the people that have, you know, I've had the real great pleasure of working. I've worked with you, Mark, for many, many years. And, you know, these friendships are made. And therefore, the whiskies mean more to me than if I've celebrated with people along the way. And that's what it's all about. It's about sharing memories, sharing, you know, drinks and whiskey. And whiskey brings people together. So if I can celebrate with other people, that will mean more to me than anything else.
If you've never had the chance to sit in on one of Richard's tastings, believe me, it's a unique experience. Back in the Jura episode of the Fagile series in May, we heard Richard's take on tasting whiskies. He has an equally unique way of telling the history of Scotch whiskey.
So what I want to do to you is to make sure that you leave here under this wonderful cellar here with something that you've probably felt. And I want you to feel the spirit of Scotland. So in the beginning, the Scots actually called it Ishkopeia, literally meaning the water of life. Because it was water more than anything that gave whiskey its backbone and its character. So they took that name, Ushkabeya, and they anglicized it. Ushkabeya Iski Iski Whiskey. That's how the name came about. Probably unknown to the Greeks or the Romans, because there's no mention whatsoever of their poems or their plays. Generally speaking, whiskey distillation is attributed to the time of King Henry II, because when he was over in Ireland in 1172, 1173, he came across actual distilleries in operation. So everybody thinks because Ireland and Scotland is only 16 miles of a difference, it must have been the Irish that brought it in to Scotland, and it was, of course, the Scots that perfected whiskey. Now, the Irish bringing it into Scotland, total and utter bollocks, because it probably was the Scandinavians. After all, they had got to America before Christopher Columbus on Friday, the 12th of October, 1492, at six in the morning. But irrespective of being the Scandinavians or the Irish, one thing is certain. Who were the people that knew the art of distillation? A bunch of alcoholics known as Christian missionary monks. These were the people that really made it happen. But what pushed them, what motivated them? We have to go over to China. In China, in 1333, those volcanic eruptions, there was floods, there was pestilence, and from there, we get the Black Death. The Black Death scourges right across Europe, thanks to the Silk Road, which emanated in the old capital of China, right up to Venice. 4,000 miles, the Silk Road, and it expanded out. As it expanded out, it spread the Black Death, killing no less than 75 million people. So the poor people, the infirm people, had to get a cure, had to get a medicine. So they went to see their doctors, they went to see their hospitals, but they didn't exist. Only the Cistercian monks, the Benedictine monks, the Grey Friars, the Black Friars, only the religious orders could hopefully come up with some form of cure. So within the confines of many of the monasteries, they already had the alembic stills operating. And of course, the white spirit came off the still, just like this is here. It came off and they put it into a glass. Then they went to their herbs and spice gardens. They mixed an elixir and they said, this is a cure against the Black Death. So eagerly, the poor people drank it. And as it went down their throats, because it contained alcohol, it gave them life. And that's why we call it Aqua Vitae Eau de Vie Ushkabeya, meaning the water of life. But instead, it's the religious orders staying to look after their people, that all religions should do. You must look after your people. Do you think for 1 minute they looked after their people? Another load of bollocks. Because in fact, what they did was they hid their secrets of the art of distillation, their cures, and they went from one country to another, giving people the taste of alcohol. So it very much became part of it. But they left the thousands, millions of people to die and left alone. So naturally, the cracks in religion began to appear. That's why we take the power from the church and put it into the universities. And when Henry VIII hits the throne in England, some of you have been to England, what a horrible place. Anyway, never mind about that. When, of course, Henry VIII hits the throne, naturally on 10:30, 21st of April, 1509, that Henry VII, of course, had died. He had established the Tudor dynasty, and he's looking for a son. So he marries Catherine of Aragon to bring Spain with England to fight against France. To cut a long story short, Catherine of Aragon marrying her, then, of course, the Anne Boleyn coming into his life, getting her pregnant in January 1533, quickly marry her on the 25th of January 1533, and then on Saturday between 1 o'clock, 2 o'clock, 7th of September 1533, we get Elizabeth I of England. And of course, he's running out of money. And where is the money? With all the divorce going on, etc., it's in the church. So between 1536 to 1541, King Henry VIII breaks down 823 monasteries, makes 10,600 monks redundant out of a job. So they have to leave their monasteries, their churches in England, and they cross the border into Scotland. And with them, they bring the art of distillation with them. So it comes a way of life. When the farmers, the local farmers, distill it, they help to pay for their food, their rent, and their general survival. It becomes a way of life for producing their malt whiskey. Like all of you today, you know, you get heavily taxed with working. Well, this is what they did. They said, let's tax these hairy bums in Scotland. Let's say any form of aqua vitae, we're going to charge you guys 1 8 pence per pint. To cut a long story short, the Scots said, wait a minute, whiskey is our traditional national drink. Why should we pay these taxes? So they avoided it completely. And of course, it got out of hand. They drank it. They enjoyed it. It was a way of life to drink 2 bottles of whiskey before they started their work first thing in the morning. Just looking at some of you, you're obviously doing that still today, but never mind. But anyway, malt whiskey gets taxed and they avoid the taxation. Then, of course, what they said, the government says, wait a minute, this alcoholism is going into armies and our navies. Let's curb it. So they got together with the distillers and they said, what's your problems? What's your grievances? It's all this smuggling, all this brandy coming in from France. Let's make it a level playing field. So they came up with the Excise Act to try and encourage proper legal distillation. It came into effect on Friday, the 18th of July, 1823. It said, if you want to produce whiskey, you need a license. It's going to cost you $20. Duty is going to be charged at 2 4 pence a farthing per proof gallon, but 40 gallons is going to become the legal minimum size you are still. One by one, the distillers took out their licenses for producing, remember, never forget, malt whiskey. And that's what got underway. So when you think of the pot still, think of single malt, think of cognac, think of rum. But not the ladies, like Kat over there, Catherine over here. They didn't like it. It's too heavy, it's too aggressive. So the patent still was looked at as an alternative method, a lighter, more fragrant whiskey for gin, vodka, white rum, and of course, grain whiskey. That's what we're looking for. So the idea was thought, well, wait a minute, we've got the patent still and we've got the pot still. Why don't we mix the two together? And the man that perfected the art of whiskey blending was this man here. As you look around, you might see some champagnes, hopefully Dom Perignon. Well, he was born in 1638 and died in 1715. Whereas this great man here was born in 1826 and died on the 1st of November, 1898. The year that you've got to remember is 1860. 1860. That's when Andrew Usher Jr. pioneered the art of whiskey blending. And he took his whiskey, he put it into the market, and because it was soft and elegant, refined, he made a fortune from it. And that's what really established the liquid gold blended Scotch whiskey, which still accounts for 92% of the market as we know today. So the way in which we distill it and the way in which we blend it still is relevant today. How many of you have not been to Scotland? Hands up, who's not been to Scotland? Quite a number of you. Now, don't worry, because we're not all running around with our skits and our kilts and what have you, and chasing haggises and what have you. But it is a lovely place. It rains a lot, what have you, but it is wonderful. When you look at Scotland, this is Scotland here, covered in ice 20,000 years ago, known as the Great Eurasian Glacier. It is 276 miles long by 147 miles wide, has a coast on 5,006.6 nautical miles, 721 islands, 161 of them are smaller, about 90 acres, and they've got sheep on them. And after 10 days, the sheep are goddamn beautiful. So you've got to remember that's the sort of style of Scotland. But as we speak, at the present moment, we have 106 distilleries in operation. Like all of you here today, each one of you has your own particular character. And that's the same with the whiskies. Just like the wines that you see here today, they have their own particular style, character, and everything else that goes with it. Well, whiskey is no exception. So we draw an imaginary line between Green and Captain D. The whiskies below that line are known as lowland malts. Because the land is fairly flat, the whiskies are going to be of similar nature. Light in body, charm, elegance, but more importantly, femininity. But if you want muscle, backbone, structure, you have to come to the Highland region. And that's where the changes occur. The Speyside Valley. Many people think it's a separate area. Bollocks. It's all part of the Highland region. 44 distilleries are found in that one area alone. The River Spey, the fastest flowing river in Great Britain, runs for 36 miles, but there are 26 distilleries in its bank, but each one is different in its own way. So when you leave the Speyside Valley, when you go beyond Inverness, you come to individuality. You come to Dalmore, Glenmorangie, Pulteney, Brora, Clynelish, all wonderful independent distilleries that have their own style. Down to Campbellton, used to be 37 distilleries there. Now there's only three, Springbank, Glengyle, Glen Scotia, and then over to Islay, medicinal, smoky, peppery. But the softer ones that Bruichladdy and Bunahabhain. So four distinctive areas, Lowlands, Highlands, Campbelltons and Islays. The grain whiskies, mainly centred between Glasgow and Edinburgh, although our own distillery, Invergordon's up north. Now, never forget, a patent still, like Invergordon, will be capable of producing 40 million litres of alcohol, whereas Dalmore, 3 miles down the road, only 4.7. So you can see the ratio between one and the other. The distillery that you're smelling just now is Dalmore, away beyond Inverness, half an hour over the road, up the road. You know, Mark's been there, he's seen it. If you ever want to be involved with it and see the character of it, you must come to the distillery. You must see it. When you go to the vineyard and you buy a wine from Joe here, you must sense the vineyard, sense the style, the great variety, what goes into it. Well, of course, Dalmore's the same. Dalmore Distillery was established in 1839, same year that Cézanne the painter was born, the father of modern art. And of course, it was about the 10th of October, 1839, that Queen Victoria fell in love with Prince Albert. And of course, as you know, that was her love of his life before he died on the 14th of December, 1861. But anyway, we start off with Dalmore. Alexander Matheson comes in, buys a distillery. The people like the Sullivans, don't forget their names, shower of bastards, because they were the people that came in and said, who are you people? Two-legged. No, we want four legs. And that's why they brought the sheep in and got rid of the people. Then the Perrins. Heard of the Perrins? You must have heard. Perrins? Yes, you have. Lee and Perrins sauce of Worcester sauce. That is the people that came in and bought some of the mill. But in 1867, the Mackenzies arrived. They went into full production on Monday, 26th of January, 1868. And we've never looked back since. So those have never been to the distillery. When you come, when you go over the Black Isle and look to the horizon and see the Dalmore Distillery, look to see what you can see. Because that will tell you something about the distillery. First of all, you see the mighty Ben Wyvis in the background. So when you see this mountain in the background, what's it going to be like? Is it going to be soft and elegant? Is it going to be a little bit pussy or what have you? No, it's not. It's going to have muscle, backbone, structure. It's facing the North Sea, so the winds come in and blast against the warehouse and mold the character. Then you go and watch the stills. Very important. What makes one distillery different? When you go to Jura, that's the one you've been to, Mark. When you go to Jura, you see large stills. They are large. They're not small. They're tall. 24 feet, 4¾ inches tall. They're lamp-shaped. When you go to Dalmore, they're bowl-shaped. But they're big. They're fat. They're bulbous. That's what we call them, the big bastards. Because, in fact, 1874, the stills are still there to this very day. But then what do? We transfer and transform Dalmore into something unique. How do we do it? Thanks to you guys here in America. First of all, you caress it, you flirt with it, and you give us the American white oak from the Ozark mountain range of Missouri. 40,000 square miles of natural forest. And we cut the trees down, you get 2 barrels per tree. Then we give it to the bourbon boys and they fire it, char it. And after 2 years, they send it over to us. We fill it with our Dalmore, but it's not enough. We need to really dress it. So when you go home tonight and have a bath, have a shower, you change into your suit, your dress, or what have you. How do you feel? More motivated, more stimulated. And that's what I must do with my whiskey. Stimulate it so that when we put it on the market, people will be seduced by its warm, lovely, seductive flavors. Because down in Jerez de la Frontera, we have sherry. And I say the word sherry, not cherry, as some people think. Sherry, S-H-E-R-R-Y. What is sherry? It's a fortified wine. And I'm shouting at you because out there, when I say sherry to a lot of people, what's sherry? It's a beautiful, lovely, fortified wine. We have Oloroso, a Manzanilla, a Amontillado, but we also have Oloroso. So I go to Gonzalez Baez, the lovely bodegas of Gonzalez Baez, and I buy my 30-year-old Methusalem. Wait a minute, Methusalem, do not use that word in rum. Yes, but when it comes to sherry, it means exceptionally old, 30 years. And when I buy the cask, I will pay $2,000 for one empty cask. One empty cask, 600 liters, 52 and a half inches long. Do they like it up in the distillery? No, they don't. They hate it. Oh, my back is sore. All these, again, more pieces. Oh, I can't work with this. Health and safety. What a load of shite. Oh, sorry, don't repeat that. Anyway, but basically speaking, that's what happens. Because in my father's day, my grandfather's, we used to work at it. We never complained. We got on with it. So we put them into the warehouse to begin the long sleep. But once again, I must reinforce, you're not allowed to add sherry to it. When it arrives with some 3 liters of sherry that's kept it nice and damp, we take that sherry out. Then we put our 10-year-old Dalmore in. We leave it for 2-3 years. And then when it becomes 13 years old, we take 50% sherry, 50% American white oak, and put it together. Then we put it into the market when we finally bottle it. Now, once again, I must emphasize this to you. This is a Capita nosing glass. Take a good look at it, because this is what I use. My father, my grandfather, that my grandfather had a smaller one. The lip, the sort of angle here was slightly shorter. But what you need to do is to make sure that when you smell the new spirit, it is up to the standard. But when we look at the Dalmore, good. Just take a short bit. When we look at the Dalmore, we need to look at it properly. So what you do, and what Mark will know when I go to my sample room in Glasgow, is I put it in the glass, swirl it around, and what I do, yes, I put it on the floor. Because what you do is you must make sure the lip of the glass is absolutely clean. This acts as a trough. That's why you need to get rid of it. You can do it with whiskey because it'll never stain the carpet. Wine, that's different. Then you go back to it a second time and you fill it up. And you fill it up. And this is what is so, so important. When you see wine tasters, when you see whiskey tasters, especially at the whiskey festivals, look at their faces, look at the actions. Because if I ever see you holding a glass like this and nosing it like this, we're still this part. Watch them. You'll see them doing this quite often, like this. And then the other one that really annoys me is this, hello, I'm ballooning it, I'm warming it. It's like a fine cognac. Is that what you're doing? So what I always do is take 2 fingers and stick it in their eyes. Now, don't let me ever see you doing this. Don't let me ever see you doing this. Worse still, this, because it means nothing. What I want you to do is to go out into that big, big world and do it properly. You swirl it around, bring it up, and you say, hello. And then you go back and say, how are you? And then you go back up and say, quite well, thank you very much. So what you need to do is to bring it up, and you put it right in your nose. Now, you can see I've got a big nose because my great-great-grandfather was, of course, Sir Ranulph de Bergerac. He was born 28th of October, 1616, died, of course, about 1677. But anyway, 28th of July. So therefore, what you need to do is to make sure you get into it and say hello. The alcohol will hit your nose first. That's why you move it from one side to the other. And then you go back to it and say hello. Then you go back to it and say, how are you? And then you go back up to it and say, quite well, thank you very much. So when you see a woman, smell her, like all the women I've smelled here tonight, I pass them, you wait 1, 2, 3 seconds, and then you go, hello. And sometimes Chanel No. 5 comes up. You know, lovely Gabriel Auguste Chanel, born, when is she born? She was born, yes, 19th of August. That's why you get to Chanel No. 19. 19th of August, 1883. Same as the Brooklyn Bridge, of course, the 25th of March. Anyway, and then, of course, she died on the 10th of January, Sunday, at the Ritz Theatre, of course, the Ritz Hotel, 1971. But in 1925, Ernest Beaux released the Chanel No. 5 of the 10 samples, No. 5, her lucky day. That's why she always had, of course, the fashion shows on the 5th of May. Anyway, nevertheless, she has the top notes. What's the top note of Chanel? Bulgarian roses and jasmine. So when you look at Dalmore, it will have a top note too. And it will be, of course, can anybody tell me? Of course you know it. Can you smell it? Come on, 26 different nuances. What can you smell? What can you smell? Anything? Come on, guys. Come on, ladies. What can you smell? Citrus, that's it. Well done. Absolutely brilliant. Totally. You should be smelling oranges. You should be smelling lovely marzipan. You should be smelling chocolate, a little bit of coffee. That lovely marmalade notes that are coming through. Marmalade, of course, taken from Mary Queen of Scots, who, of course, married the Dauphin of France. She became Marie as she married the French king. And then, of course, he died in 1561. So she had to reclaim her throne. So she got the first galleon over. It was the 19th of August, 1561. And it was a very rough crossing. So Marie, she was sick. She was Marie Malade. And that's how you get the name Marmalade. Did you know that? Well, that's how it came about. And then, of course, she was executed on the 8th of February, 1587, when she put her head in the block. He brought the axe down, hit her on the back of the neck, spurting with blood, and then down again, never quite severed the head, more blood, and then the final chop, and the third head finally came off. And that's why we get the cocktail, a Bloody Mary. Yes, there we go, there we go. I'm glad to see some of you have been drinking a few Bloody Marys in your time. Anyway, this is in fact Dalmore. So what I want you to do is to bring it up and caress it and to warm it. Now remember, don't knock it back like a cowboy. Now I have to say I'm very angry with you Americans because many years ago you had these wonderful cowboy films. Do you remember them? The cowboy walks into the saloon, kicks the door open, goes up and says, give me a whiskey, and he knocks it back. Do you think for one minute he goes, hello, hello? He doesn't do any of that. But what you need to do is to take some water. Remember when you pick up a jug of water? This isn't a jug, but never pick it up by the handle. Make sure you put the fingers in the water. You must test it, because quite often I burnt myself, especially in America. So you need to take a little spot of water, reduce it down to 35% alcohol, but not knock it back. What you do is this. Hello there. Okay? You keep it in the top of your mouth, underneath your mouth, back in the middle, and then let it go down. By keeping it in the mouth, you will open it up a little bit more. But when you go back to the second taste, which is the most important taste, not the first taste, but the second taste, it will open up to you. Spicy, orange, then you get the cinnamon, then you get the sort of licorice and ginger, but then the citrus fruits will come in towards the end. That is the Dalmore 12 years old. 50% American white oak, 50% sherry. Okay, we all got that now?
I'm in a quiet part of the catacombs in the basement at Federal Wine and Spirits with Joe Howell, the whiskey expert here. Joe, tell me about the collection you've managed to build up over here for sale at Federal Wine.
It's just about the customer and what their needs and wants. Whether, you know, you have deep pockets and you're looking for a great bottle, or money's a little tighter and you're still looking for a great bottle. It's about making people enjoy and appreciate and get the scotch that works for them. I'm not on commission. It's about taking a little time to appreciate and enjoy. We work too hard, life's too short. And when you can take a few minutes and just enjoy a single malt, you should be enjoying, not just drinking something that you're drinking because you bought the bottle and you really don't like it. You'd rather pour it for company. And that's where 200 bottles open every day and more. I guarantee bottles. If I know a few things that you like, I want you to enjoy and take a little time for yourself. Used to be a 5-day work week, 8-hour work day. Weekends were for you. Now we don't have 15 minutes that we can take a little time and just think. So when you get a chance, enjoy, appreciate, especially with friends and a great single malt. You're not going wrong.
And that's one of the things that's helped you build up a reputation here as one of the best retailers in the Northeast, in the New England area. Give me a sense of the range here, because you've got all the basics covered, all the way up to some extremely rare things, right?
And that's where, you know, I have a boss that I have to answer to, and the money on the shelf is tied up, but that's where I want people, whether it's $30, $40, $2,000, or $20,000, I want what you're buying to really work for you. And I'd rather sell to somebody that's buying rather than collecting, because Hummels, Matchbox cars, things like that are for collecting. Whiskey is for drinking. And that's where there's always new things coming out to enjoy, appreciate. Take a little time for yourself.
What have you been most impressed by in new releases over the last year or so?
Well, it's nice to see Springbank coming back alive and really putting out some great whiskeys. The smaller independent distilleries, you know, I love, just because they're working hard and it's not an easy game. The bigger guys, they have a lot behind them and big corporate money, but it's about what you enjoy. And I mean, there's been a lot of great whiskeys, and that's where people should have more time to enjoy, appreciate. But bars and restaurants cry because business could be tight. Put some more single malts on your shelves. Let people come in, taste, try, enjoy, but they don't want to work it, and that's where they're missing out.
One of the things I noticed looking at your shelves was something that's become sort of a regional favorite around here is the Cabin Fever from local guys up in Vermont that have mixed whiskey with maple syrup. I had the Robillards on back in April at Whiskey Live New York. But that sort of has become a cult favorite around this region, right?
Now, these are people that I'm dying to get into the store and work with. They've been on the boat cruise from Whiskey Guild and many other big tastings throughout the country, and spend a lot of money for a mom-and-pop sort of organization. But they have a great product, and that's where one of the biggest companies, Macallan, they put out the amber and they dropped it. And I had more people looking from throughout the U.S., throughout the world for that bottle. And this is one of the largest marketing companies in the world, and people were looking and really trying to get that product, and they just said, we're discontinuing it. And things happen for a reason, but maybe it was Cabin Fever's lucky break. But they're putting out a great product at a very affordable price, and a product that can really be utilized and enjoyed. And that's where, if you're sitting home and drinking single malt and that's not your favorite, well, this is where you're having company that don't drink single malt. It's a great product to put in front of them and let them try, taste, see if they enjoy. And drink your single malt and enjoy. But it's about what you like, and take a little time and smell the roses.
Locally here in Massachusetts, I know you guys got hit with a tax increase at July 1st. Has that cut into business, or is it too soon to tell?
People adapt very easily, and that's where, you know, it goes with the flow. But when the tax went into effect, that was our biggest day ever. We, even at Christmas holiday, which is a big season, we surpassed the numbers by far and well beyond our expectations. And that's where hopefully it will be repealed, but I really doubt they'll let that money go. And since it all started, the taxation has been one of the biggest problems. They get greedy, they want to take too much. Let people enjoy, appreciate. the world, it all flows, and that's where they don't take enough time. They want to sort of take what they can and not worry about the industries they affect.
Is that the biggest problem you face as a retailer, is taxes?
Well, I have importers, wholesalers, distributors, and bring them on down. And I have a boss, and that's where I fight the fight, and it's about the customer. Enjoy, appreciate, take a little time for yourself, and drink the best products you can. And even if you can't, come into Federal. We'll taste you. Not a problem.
Now, you also were actually doing some importing yourself for a while with the Black Adder range, right?
Well, that's where it was an incredible whiskey brand that wasn't being seen in the U.S. and many other places as well. But places that it was seen were really positive towards it, and whiskey the way the connoisseur wanted it. And I pushed my boss to bring it in and put the money up behind it, and we had problems with it. And it's any business can have problems. But that's where the whiskey is phenomenal, and try a Black Adder. I had people bidding on bottles that I wouldn't sell so they could acquire them and would have paid almost any price. And I was like, bring it on down. And that's where, you know, I don't hesitate to open a bottle and taste somebody like Richard Patterson on it, even though Robin couldn't ruffle his feathers a little bit.
And that's moved on to a different importer now, but you're still selling it, right?
Without a doubt, and I hope the importer is working quick and getting it out, because they should be out within about 2 weeks or 3 weeks. I mean, they're running late and going a little slow, but with the economy, everyone is. And that's where, try Blackadder, taste Blackadder. The whiskeys are very different, because just like when you're at a distillery, it's as close as you can be to tasting a whiskey at a distillery, out of a barrel, without the tax man, and let the true product speak out, and enjoy and appreciate where you want to drink it, with water, without water, but give it time, show it some water. Those whiskeys just open up, and there's so much depth and intricacies. You can't take enough time with them.
One final question. Richard Patterson let you taste the Delmore Oculus tonight, the very old 59-year-old expression. What'd you think of it?
I still have a concussion from the boom in the back of my head, but well worth it. And that's where phenomenal whiskey, and the depth and intricacies were just immense. Balance, yes. There was a little wood there, but holy Toledo, it was just absolute finesse, and there's a lot of history in that glass. I would have rather sat with that for an hour and really appreciated what I was drinking. I mean, I did appreciate it, and I saw it, but I had no idea what I was getting into when I tasted it, and that's where amazing stuff.
Now, I didn't get to try that 59-year-old Delmore, but during the evening's masterclass, Joe and Richard poured the 1973 Gonzales Bias Delmore, bottled at 42% and pretty much unavailable these days. The nose has a slight pepperiness and a hint of fruits with a light orange note and notes of malt and grass. The taste is rich with a good spiciness at first that fades to reveal orange notes and a lemon tartness, and the finish is smooth and lingering with a citrusy tartness. Outstanding, well-balanced, I'm giving the Delmore 1973 Gonzales Bias bottling a 97, a truly memorable dram. Earlier, Richard and I discussed the Delmore Clanmackenzie bottling. As he mentioned, it's 17 years old, finished in port wine casks, and bottled at 46% ABV. The nose is a complex mix of orange marmalade, allspice, red grapes, and a hint of pipe tobacco. The taste starts off with cinnamon spice that fades slowly to reveal those same orange marmalade notes from the nose, and a slight tartness, along with a touch of oak that carries into the finish. It's very smooth, consistent, and well-balanced, and I'm giving the Delmore Clanmackenzie bottling a 94.
Finally, I'd like to thank Joe Howell and everyone at Federal Wine and Spirits for inviting me up to Boston, along with Lee Stander and Don Lambert of White & Mackay, and everyone I met at the tastings that night. I had a great time, and I'm looking forward to my next trip to Boston. You can find my tasting notes in the WhiskeyCast iPhone app, sponsored by the Glenrothes, and at the WhiskeyCast website. That's also where you'll find links to the WhiskeyCast Facebook page and my Twitter feed, the calendar of events, the WhiskeyCast store powered by Amazon.com, and, of course, a complete archive of past episodes. The address is www.whiskeycast.com, and my email address for questions and suggestions is comments@whiskeycast.com. I'd love to hear from you. WhiskeyCast is a production of Cask Strength Media, copyright 2010, and comes to you from the charming, yet regrettably dry town of Haddonfield, New Jersey. I'm Mark Gillespie, reminding you that when you drink, please drink responsibly. Thanks for listening.